The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Scott R. Anderson, and this is the Lawfare Podcast.
Shorts.
Yesterday, congressional investigators heard closed-door testimony from Ambassador William Taylor, the chargé d'affaires for the U.S. Embassy in Kiev, Ukraine. The Washington Post, however, secured and released a copy of Taylor's opening testimony, which revealed sordid details of the unfolding Ukraine scandal. Here is the analysis that I wrote for Lawfare, entitled, What Bill Taylor's Testimony Adds to the Ukraine Story. On Tuesday, October 22nd, congressional committees investigating l'affaire ukrainienne heard long-awaited testimony from Ambassador William Taylor, the career diplomat who has spent the last 4 months running the U.S. Embassy in Kiev following President Trump's removal of Ambassador Maria Yovanovitch. While Taylor testified behind closed doors, his opening statement provides an unvarnished view of the motivations that appear to have driven Trump and others to push for investigations into Trump's political rivals and threaten to withhold Ukrainian security assistance. The result is a far uglier picture than what has emerged from prior testimony, one that bears directly on the question of corrupt motive that lies at the heart of the House's ongoing impeachment inquiry. Many of the events that Taylor describes in his testimony are likely to be familiar, but the window that his statements provides into the discussions and deliberations surrounding U.S. policy towards the Ukraine over the past several months is an invaluable addition to prior accounts, and it's worth examining in some detail. Here, I review Taylor's account and situate it within what was already known about the scandal. From there, I consider what ramification is it likely to have for other current and former U.S. officials who have been implicated in l'affaire ukrainienne, and how it adds to our understanding of whether or not President Trump has engaged in impeachable conduct. Taylor's testimony. Taylor describes how he arrived in Kiev in mid-June 2019 to find two channels of U.S. policymaking and implementation, one regular and one highly irregular. The latter, he writes, was well-connected in Washington, but operated mostly outside of official State Department channels, and included then-Special Envoy Kurt Volker, Ambassador Gordon Sondland, Secretary of Energy Rick Perry, and Rudolph Giuliani. Both channels were eager to arrange a telephone call between Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, as well as a promised White House visit for the latter in hopes of strengthening the U.S.-Ukraine bilateral relationship. But as Taylor describes, it soon became clear that the two had in fact diverged in their objectives. The irregular channels soon began to take steps to limit outside knowledge of the participants' activities. Taylor describes how Sondland sought to exclude other interagency participants from a June 28th call with Zelensky for the express purpose of making sure no one was transcribing or monitoring the call. During that call, Sondland and Volker informed the other participants that they planned to be explicit with Zelensky about what he should do to get the White House meeting, in an in-person meeting scheduled a few days later. According to Taylor, Volker described Trump as wanting to see rule of law, transparency, but also, specifically, cooperation on investigations to get to the bottom of things. By mid-July, however, Taylor notes that he had come to realize that the meeting Zelensky wanted was conditioned on the investigations of Burisma and alleged Ukrainian interference in the 2016 U.S. elections, a condition being driven by the irregular policy channel I had come to understand was guided by Mr. Giuliani. Around this time, Taylor also became aware that the Office of Management and Budget, or OMB, had placed a hold on security assistance to Ukraine, pursuant to a directive that had come from the President to the Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney to OMB. Despite strong, unanimous agreement among relevant agencies at National Security Council, or NSC, meetings that the security assistance was effective and should continue, the hold remained inexplicably in place. According to Taylor, this led him to conclude that the irregular policy channel had begun running contrary to the goals of longstanding U.S. policy. In the days prior to the July 25th call, Taylor had exchanges with Sondland and Volker in which they described having coached Zelensky on how to engage Trump by recommending that Zelensky say that he will help the investigation and tell Trump he will leave no stone unturned in relation to them. According to Taylor, this led one of Zelensky's advisors to tell him that Zelensky did not want to be used as a pawn in a U.S. re-election campaign, a concern that Taylor relayed to Sondland and Volker by text. After the notorious July 25th call occurred, Taylor notes that, strangely, even though I was chief of mission and was scheduled to meet with Zelensky along with Ambassador Volker the following day, I received no readout of the call from the White House. He only received an informal readout from an NSC official several days later, who said the call could have been better and acknowledged that Trump had suggested that Zelensky or his staff meet with Giuliani and Attorney General William Barr. Taylor claims that he did not see the full memorandum of the call until the White House publicly released it several weeks later. It is clear that, by this point, Taylor had become immensely concerned. On August 16th, after hearing from Volker that Ukrainian official had asked that the United States submit an official request to reopen a Ukrainian investigation into Burisma, Taylor strongly advised that the United States stay clear and referred Volker to a relevant Justice Department official. After being told by Morrison that the president doesn't want to provide any assistance at all to the Ukrainians, Taylor says he began preparing to resign. At the suggestion of then-National Security Advisor John Bolton, Taylor first sent a cable to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo describing the folly I saw in withholding military aid to Ukraine and stating that he could not and would not defend such a policy on August 29th. That same day, the story of the hold on security assistance broke, leading Ukrainian officials to contact Taylor for an explanation, something he was embarrassed he could not give them. As for his cable, Taylor received no specific response, other than a report that Pompeo had carried the cable into a related meeting at the White House. A few days later, Taylor learned from Morrison of a conversation Sondland had had with a senior advisor to Zelensky a few days earlier, in which Sondland asserted that the security assistance money would not come until Zelensky committed to pursue the Burisma investigation. In alarm, Taylor texted Sondland and Volker seeking confirmation, to which Sondland replied, "Call me." On the subsequent call, Sondland confirmed that President Trump had told him that he wants Zelensky to state publicly that Ukraine will investigate Burisma and alleged Ukrainian interference in the 2016 U.S. election. As Sondland told Taylor, everything was dependent on a public announcement of investigations, not just a White House meeting. According to Sondland, President Trump wanted Zelensky in a public box by making a public statement about ordering such investigations. Taylor urged Sondland to push back on Trump's demand, and Sondland reportedly agreed to try. The two also discussed having the Ukrainian prosecutor general make a statement in lieu of Zelensky, potentially in coordination with Attorney General Barr's probe into the investigation of interference in the 2016 elections. Over the next several days, Taylor and other U.S. policymakers met with Ukrainian leaders expressing concern that U.S. security assistance might not be forthcoming. Both Taylor and other officials sought to assuage their concerns by noting the strong bipartisan support for such assistance. But Taylor worried that this official foreign policy of the United States had been undercut by the irregular efforts led by Mr. Giuliani. On September 7th, Taylor received a readout from Morrison of a conversation between Sondland and Trump that Morrison described as giving him a sinking feeling. In that conversation, Trump had insisted he was not asking for a quid pro quo, but nonetheless insisted that Zelensky himself announce the opening of investigations into Biden and 2016 election interference. The next day, Sondland told Taylor that he had delivered this message to Zelensky, noting that Trump was adamant that Zelensky himself clear things up and do it in public in order to avoid a stalemate, which Taylor understood to mean that Ukraine would not receive the much-needed military assistance. This exchange resulted in a commitment by Zelensky to publicly announce the investigations in an interview with CNN. Taylor texted Sondland about his reservations later that day, reiterating what Taylor describes in his testimony as a serious threat that he would resign if Zelensky gave the interview and did not receive the security assistance. He followed up further on September 8th, asserting, "I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign." Several hours later, Sondland responded by noting that they should not continue the conversation by text, echoing Trump's line that there was no quid pro quos of any kind, and encouraging Taylor to raise any remaining reservations with Pompeo. While Taylor does not discuss this in his testimony, it's notable that the Inspector General for the Intelligence Community informed the House Intelligence Committee of the whistleblower's complaint that same day. This led Chairman Adam Schiff to request the complaint the next day. When this request was refused, Schiff followed up with a public subpoena a few days later, on September 13th. Taylor writes that, on September 11th, the hold on security assistance for Ukraine was lifted without explanation. Taylor conveyed the news to Zelensky and his advisors and sought to confirm that neither Zelensky nor anyone in his government planned to follow through on his reported commitment to Sondland to announce investigations on CNN. Zelensky's advisors indicate that they did not, though Taylor notes that one official who had been Giuliani's main interlocutor looked uncomfortable. Taylor closes his narrative by noting that Trump and Zelensky finally met in person on September 25th, after the story of the whistleblower had gone public. That same day, the White House released the transcript of the July 25th call, which Taylor recalls seeing for the first time. He notes that the White House gave the Ukrainians virtually no notice of the release, leaving them livid. Taylor notes unequivocally that he understood the references to investigations in the July 25th call as describing matters related to the 2016 elections and to investigations of Burisma and the Bidens. Implications and consequences. No one comes away from Taylor's narrative looking good. The officials who behaved the least objectionably are arguably Bolton and his NSC staffers, namely Morrison, Morrison's predecessor Fiona Hill, who resigned in August, and their colleague Alex Vindman. Taylor describes this group as repeatedly voicing concerns with the actions and objectives of the irregular policy channel, reporting that Bolton at one point became so irritated with Sondland's efforts to tie a White House meeting to investigations that he cut a meeting with Ukrainian officials abruptly short, directed his subordinates to brief the lawyers about Sondland's proposed drug deal, and even opposed a call between Zelensky and Trump out of concern that it would be a disaster. Yet none of these officials took serious steps to oppose or disrupt these efforts. Nor did Taylor himself, for that matter, despite the candor with which he repeatedly raised his concerns. Sondland and Volker come out badly damaged by Taylor's account. In their own testimony before congressional investigators earlier this month, each disclaimed any knowledge of the link between Trump's sustained emphasis on investigations and corruption had anything to do with the Bidens, asserting that they thought it related only to investigations into 2016 election interference, and that they did not know that Burisma, which was repeatedly named as a desired target of those investigations, was the Ukrainian gas company with which Hunter Biden was associated. These claims were never very credible. Taylor blows them up entirely, making clear that both Volker and Sondland were not only fully aware of the regular channel's demands, but were often directly involved in advancing them both internally and with Ukrainian counterparts. Sondland, in particular, appears to have been a central facilitator in the irregular channel machinations, in sharp contrast with his own efforts to portray himself as a well-intentioned, if woefully underinformed, bystander. This discrepancy seems certain to carry consequences for his credibility, if not more. Meanwhile, Energy Secretary Rick Perry, the third amigo supposedly charged with managing the Trump administration's Ukraine policy, plays only a bit part in Taylor's narrative, leaving questions about his full-level involvement unanswered. Taylor also makes only scant mention of Giuliani, in part because their direct interactions appear to have been limited. Instead, Giuliani appears to have worked primarily through Sondland and Volker. Also left bloodied are Mulvaney and Pompeo. Taylor leaves no doubts that Mulvaney was directly responsible for placing the hold on security assistance to Ukraine, noting a comment by NSC staffers that Mulvaney himself maintained a skeptical view of Ukraine. Moreover, while Mulvaney has insisted publicly that the administration always intended to provide the assistance by the end of the fiscal year, Taylor says he relayed to Ukrainian officials his understanding that it was an all-or-nothing proposition, meaning the security assistance would disappear permanently if the hold were not lifted by September 30th. Pompeo does not feature prominently, but Taylor's testimony clearly implies that he is complicit. After all, Taylor informed Pompeo's counselor, Ulrich Breckbull, of his concerns and ultimately wrote a personal cable to Pompeo expressing those worries, with no apparent response or reaction by the secretary. And Sondland's willingness to invoke Pompeo in admonishing Taylor for suggesting that Trump had tied security assistance to the investigations leaves little doubt that Pompeo was in on the irregular scheme. Pompeo personally asked Taylor to come out of pseudo-retirement to take the reins in Kiev following Yovanovitch's removal, and Taylor seems markedly disappointed in Pompeo's failures to take action or meaningfully intervene to defend longstanding U.S. foreign policy interests. Perhaps this is one of the factors that led Taylor to testify in spite of the White House's objections to the impeachment inquiry, and why so many other State Department employees appear to be following suit. The person who looks the worst in Taylor's account, however, is undoubtedly President Trump himself. In their testimony, Sondland and Volker lay blame most squarely on Giuliani for orchestrating the push for investigations, leaving some lingering ambiguity around Trump's level of engagement. But Taylor clearly sets out the president's direct and knowing involvement. After all, it is Trump himself who reportedly said he wants Zelensky in a public box by making a public statement about ordering the investigation. And Taylor describes in detail how Trump ultimately made the withheld security assistance contingent on such a statement, first implicitly through the OMB hold and later expressly. As Taylor writes, quote, according to Mr. Morrison, President Trump told Ambassador Sondland that he was not asking for a quid pro quo. But President Trump did insist that President Zelensky go to a microphone and say he is opening investigations of Biden and 2016 election interference, and that President Zelensky should want to do this himself. The following day, on September 8th, Ambassador Sondland and I spoke on the phone. He said, President Trump was adamant that Zelensky himself had to clear things up and do it in public. President Trump said it was not a quid pro quo. Ambassador Sondland said that he had talked to Zelensky and one of Zelensky's advisors and told them that, although this was not a quid pro quo, if Zelensky did not clear things up in public, we would be at a stalemate. I understood a stalemate to mean that Ukraine would not receive the much-needed military assistance. End quote. The only weak point in Taylor's testimony is the fact that his knowledge of Trump's statements is almost entirely secondhand and received through Sondland. To the extent that Taylor's recollections are inconsistent with Sondland's own prior testimony, then congressional investigators will no doubt need to follow up, something that Representative Will Hurd of the House Intelligence Committee has already called for. At a minimum, Sondland's role in L'Affaire Ukrainienne appears to have been more central than it once seemed, and the scrutiny he is likely to receive as part of the subsequent investigation seems likely to grow larger. The most curious part of Taylor's narrative, however, is Trump's single-minded recitation of his no quid pro quo mantra. While the phrase has become the crux of the defense Trump and his supporters have put forward, it's not clear why they believe that the lack of an explicit quid pro quo would be exculpatory. The most relevant context where this concept might arise would be criminal law, where a quid pro quo is sometimes seen as an element of bribery and honest services fraud, among other offenses. Of course, under current Justice Department legal views, Trump is effectively immune from indictment for such offenses so long as he is president. An impeachment does not require a criminal violation, making the existence of a quid pro quo far from determinative of the ongoing House inquiry. Regardless, Taylor leaves no doubts that there was, in fact, a quid pro quo proposal that Trump himself was involved in putting forward. Each time Taylor quotes Trump as asserting there is no quid pro quo, he sets it next to a description of Trump demanding exactly that. Defenders of the president will no doubt respond to this testimony by trying to impugn Taylor's credibility. But Trump may have more difficulty smearing Taylor than he has with others. Though the White House has tried to disparage Taylor as being part of a conspiracy of radical unelected bureaucrats, Taylor is not only a military veteran and widely respected career diplomat, but is also a prior Republican political appointee. He served as ambassador to Ukraine under the George W. Bush administration. He also openly disagreed with aspects of the Obama administration's Ukraine policy, and pointedly noted in his opening statement on Tuesday that he counts at least one respected former senior Republican official as a close mentor. Taylor credibly asserts that it was his sincere belief in the importance of the U.S.-Ukraine relationship that led him to accede to Pompeo's request to return to Kiev, contingent on the understanding that Taylor would resign if U.S. policy towards Ukraine were to change. It is hard to see how his decision to testify before Congress, just months after accepting that job and over Pompeo's objections, could be motivated by anything other than his sincerely held belief that, quote, our relationship with Ukraine has been fundamentally undermined by an irregular, informal channel of U.S. policymaking and by the withholding of vital security assistance for domestic political reasons, end quote. Taylor's testimony may not seem like a game changer. It adds few new facts to what was already known about Trump's actions surrounding the July 25th telephone call, conduct to which Trump himself has already admitted and that he and his supporters continue to defend. But Taylor's insider account of the manner in which he saw the Trump administration implement U.S. policy towards Ukraine, along with the motives he credibly attributes to Trump and his close advisors, are damning. They cut straight through any pretense that the Trump administration's actions reflected valid U.S. policy interests or are motivated by any objective other than the president's own political advantage. Moreover, Taylor is unsparing in describing what the consequences for broader U.S. foreign policy interests will be if such self-interested conduct goes unabated. In this sense, Taylor's testimony puts the questions raised by the House's impeachment inquiry and their consequences into even sharper relief. Now it remains for Congress to decide how it will respond. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you have a second, please share the Lawfare Podcast on social media and give us a rating or 5-star review wherever you found us. Our audio engineer and editor this week is Michaela Fogel. As always, thank you for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.